This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yi Suhi. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The International Criminal Court on Tuesday sentenced a former Islamist rebel to 9 years in prison for his role in wrecking holy sites in the ancient Malian city of Timbuktu, ending a groundbreaking cultural war crimes trial.
That's Lisa Bryant reporting from Paris. Details coming up.
Also, a closer look at U.S. immigration and an analysis of the rise of General Khalifa Haftar in Libya.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Democrat Hillary Clinton and Republican Donald Trump engaged in a contentious and at times combative first presidential debate yesterday. They clashed over foreign policy, the economy, and each other in a 90-minute debate that could be one of the pivotal moments in the 2016 election campaign. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more on the debate.
The first debate showdown between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump began with a cordial handshake. But it didn't take long for the rhetoric to heat up as the two candidates clashed over Trump's business background, Clinton's experience in government, and where each of them would like to take the country on fighting the Islamic State.
She's telling us how to fight ISIS. Just go to her website. She tells you how to fight ISIS on her website. I don't think General Douglas MacArthur would like that
too much. The next segment, we're continuing
well,
the subject of
Well, at least I have a plan to fight ISIS.
No, you're telling the enemy everything you want to do.
No, we're not.
Trump also defended his decision not to release his tax returns, which are under audit, even though past candidates have done so.
I will release my tax returns against my lawyer's wishes when she releases her 33,000 emails that have been deleted.
And I have no reason to believe that he's ever going to release his tax returns because there's something he's hiding.
But Clinton also took the opportunity to express regret over her use of a private email server while Secretary of State that has damaged her trustworthiness with voters.
I made a mistake using a private email.
That's for sure.
And if I had to do it over again, I would obviously do it differently.
The debate featured frequent interruptions, many by Trump, challenging Clinton's answers. Trump also noted she took time off to prepare for the debate.
I've been all over the place. You decided to stay home, and that's okay.
I think Donald just criticized me for preparing for this debate. And yes, I did. And you know what else I prepared for? I prepared to be president.
Clinton put Trump on the defensive, calling Trump's years-long questioning of President Barack Obama's citizenship as a racist lie. Trump continued to insist he opposed the Iraq War, despite a 2002 radio interview to the contrary. And on the issue of temperament...
Well, I have much better judgment than she does. There's no question about that. I also have a much better temperament than she has.
His cavalier attitude about nuclear weapons is so deeply troubling. So a man who can be provoked by a tweet should not have his fingers anywhere near the nuclear codes.
The two White House contenders will face off in two more debates. But next week's debate features the two vice presidential contenders, Democrat Tim Kaine and Republican Mike Pence. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
During the U.S. presidential campaign, there's been much debate about immigrants, especially those not legally authorized to be living in the country. The Pew Research Center says there are 11.1 million unauthorized immigrants in the United States as of 2014. That figure has held fairly steady since 2009. However, according to new Pew Research, the ethnic makeup of that population is shifting. Jeff Parcell is the lead author of the research. He spoke to VOA's Jody Capua first about the use of the term unauthorized immigrants in the report.
We wrestled with this over the years. Ultimately, we decided that to basically go with what the government uses as the most accurate description of this group. These are people who are unauthorized to immigrate to the United States. A lot of them, probably almost half of them, came into the country legally with papers that entitled them to enter the country and often to work on temporary visas. They became unauthorized when they stayed past the terms of the date that they were required to depart or otherwise violated the terms of admission. It's the term that the Office of Immigration Statistics in the Department of Homeland Security uses to describe their own estimates, which are in fact similar to ours.
So about half of the 11 million that we have in the country, that figure that keeps being used, about half were already here and had initially entered legally.
We estimated 40% a number of years ago and said it could be as much as 45. And the trend since then, basically, in the aggregate, the two groups that we think are the ones who sneak into the country most, that is Mexicans and other Central Americans, in the aggregate, their totals have actually gone down. You know, our supposition is that almost all of the people who come from places other than Central America and Mexico came in legally. Now, certainly some of them have snuck in, but the vast majority came with visas.
That 11 million figure has been stable for a while, but the actual demographics of that figure have changed.
That's right. The Mexican population, which is by far the largest group of unauthorized immigrants, their numbers peaked in 2007 at about 6.9 million, just under 7 million. Over the next couple of years, they dropped by about 300,000 per year, went down to about 6.4 million as of 2009. And since then, in the 5 years after 2009, the Mexican unauthorized population dropped by another 500,000. So it's at about 5.8 million, represents about 52% of the unauthorized population. At its peak, the Mexican population represented about 57 to 58% of the unauthorized population. The decline in Mexican unauthorized immigrants over the last 5 years has been offset mostly by increasing numbers from Central America, from Asia, and from Africa. So those three groups together increased by about 350,000 over the last 5 years, offsetting much of the decline in Mexicans.
So aside from those from Central America, did you find that those from Asia and sub-Saharan Africa had initially entered the country legally and then let the documents expire?
We don't really have that kind of data. We assume that they did, but that's just an assumption.
So does this information play into the debate of immigration that we see going on now in the presidential debate?
That's an interesting question. I'm afraid to a very great degree, a lot of the debate is not about data or factual information, but about how people feel about immigration and what they think is happening with immigration. So these numbers aren't especially new, and these trends are not especially new. We've been putting out these estimates and saying the numbers have been level for several years now, but that only a few of the candidates have recognized that and talked about it.
Do you know how many overall immigrants there are in the U.S. at this time?
There's about 43 million. It's about 13% of the population. You know, we're a big country. We've got 320 million people, more than 320 million. The immigrant population and the share of the population that the immigrants account for have both been going up since about 1970. In 1970, less than 5% of the population was foreign-born and amounted to about 10 million people. And since then, the numbers have increased. The share foreign-born, by historical terms, is high, but it's not the highest it's ever been. Between roughly 1870 and 1920, around 14% of the population was foreign-born. That only started to drop after we put severe restrictions on who could come to the country, which we did in the 20s. And then the Depression and World War II kept down immigration.
Jeff Purcell is the senior demographer with the Pew Research Center in Washington. He adds the percentage of foreign-born population in the U.S. could reach 19% over the next 50 years. Purcell spoke to VOA's Jody Capua.
The International Criminal Court today sentenced a former Islamist rebel to 9 years in prison for his role in wrecking holy sites in the ancient Malian city of Timbuktu. The sentencing ended a groundbreaking cultural war crimes trial. Lisa Bryant reports from Paris.
The chamber unanimously sentences you to 9 years of imprisonment. In accordance with the appeals chamber's jury,
Ahmed El-Faki El-Mahdi's sentence was the minimum requested by the prosecution. It was also far less than the 30 years he could have faced for leading and participating in the smashing of 10 holy shrines in Timbuktu in 2012, when Islamist rebels controlled the renowned trading city. El-Mahdi's early admission of guilt and remorse helped speed up his trial that opened in August at the Hague-based International Criminal Court. As presiding judge Raoul Pangalangan pointed out, it also factored into the sentencing.
The chamber has found no aggravating circumstances and 5 mitigating circumstances, namely your admission of guilt, your cooperation with the prosecution, the remorse and empathy you have expressed for the victims, your initial reluctance to commit the crime, and the steps you took to limit the damage caused.
The trial was the ICC's first ever to consider cultural destruction as a war crime. Some observers say they hope it may set a legal precedent for similar cultural crimes, such as the destruction of ancient monuments in Iraq and Syria by Islamist rebels. Rights groups also want the ICC to investigate broader crimes committed during Mali's 2012 conflict. El-Mahdi's conviction amounts to only the 4th the ICC has delivered since it began operating in 2002. The court, which has indicted individuals ranging from Ugandan rebel leader Joseph Kony to former Ivorian president Laurent Gbagbo, has also acquitted 1 defendant. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 18 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The first presidential debate between Democrat Hillary Clinton and Republican Donald Trump yesterday was contentious and at times combative. And an Islamist rebel was sentenced to 9 years in prison by the International Criminal Court. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
The political dynamics in Libya are changing now that General Khalifa Haftar is gaining prominence. His forces recently took over 4 oil terminals in the east. General Haftar commands the Libyan National Army, but is not allied with the UN-backed Government of National Accord, or GNA. Last week at the UN General Assembly session, GNA leader President Fayez Sarraj said that efforts had been made to bring together the voices of the country and that the government would continue peaceful dialogue. Among those following developments is Jason Pacht, former and founder and president of the research group Libya Analysis. He spoke with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy about the rise of General Haftar.
It totally reshuffles the alliances that have defined the struggle for the post-Gaddafi future. What we've seen until now is Haftar opposing the General National Accord government, which is based in the West. The UN-backed General National Accord government has worked with the Federalists to try to secure the oil ports. Now it seems like they're willing to work with Haftar, abandon the Federalists, and maybe have a new kind of alliance system where the Federalists and the jihadists are fighting against Haftar. I know it's very complicated, but this could be an opportunity for a breakthrough.
But would that pave the way for a stronger role of General Haftar in the Libyan future?
It certainly has. First Bernardino León and then Martin Kobler, the previous and the current UN envoy, have tried to work without Haftar because Haftar has been disruptive and has wanted to be the commander of the Libyan army in any solution. Now it seems that he can't be ignored because he's shown himself as the most powerful military force, not only in the east of the country, but also in its center. The only way probably to avoid a civil war between him and the Misratins, who control the west area of Libya and have been attacking the Islamic State in Sirte, is to either make a deal with Haftar, whereby he lets the oil flow and the revenue from the oil goes into the central bank, or to not succeed in getting that deal, and then maybe we would have something like separatism or an eastern country and a western country. It's definitely a pivotal moment for Libya.
Would that force a potential amendment to the UN-sponsored political agreement?
Well, that's a very dangerous question, a good question. It does seem to be an end to the political agreement with the given ministers and given approach that the UN has tried until now. That approach has failed. It never provided unity. So I don't think they need to scrap the whole concept of unity government. They may need to reshuffle who's included, reopen the negotiations, and that's kind of what Kobler, the UN envoy, was doing by meeting with Aqila Saleh in Cairo just a few days ago. I want to make clear that I don't think Haftar is the greatest person on the planet. I'm merely counseling that the UN and the Western countries can't ignore it and continue the same old methods that have been tried and failed.
Could that mean the possibility of forming a more representative unity government in Libya?
I think it could mean that. I don't know how amenable Haftar himself is personally to that option, but certainly some of his chief lieutenants and his supporters in the House of Representatives would have to be willing, if offered positions, to join. Libya, unfortunately, has a zero-sum culture, and this was evident in the Gaddafi period. And that means that rather than working together, two groups or three groups or four groups, to increase all of their benefits, groups are willing to fight each other to try to win the whole amount, even if that decreases the total pie. So there's a fear that it won't be possible to include people, even when working together would clearly benefit everyone, to form something of an anti-ISIS, anti-jihadist coalition.
But with the resumption of Libyan oil exports, Libyan dinar had jumped 20%, signaling Libyan streets' positive reception of the recent developments. Would that mean that Libya can find unity through oil?
I hope so. I mean, I know that that's very optimistic. It requires a lot of leadership on behalf of the different factions to work together. But if somehow the stored crude can be exported, and that's what's happening now, Libya is not producing new crude. It's rather that crude has been 2 years stored at the tankers. If those can be exported and an agreement can be made to secure building works to get the pipelines and the ports running again, this could be a great opportunity for some kind of unity because Libya needs cash to survive, and it's been running out of its reserves. So pumping oil is really the only way to produce the cash needed to do state building, to defeat the jihadis. And who knows if maybe some kind of arrangement between Haftar and the authorities in Tripoli can rechange that calculus, get the oil flowing. That does seem like the way forward.
Jason Pacht is founder and president of the research group Libya Analysis. He spoke with VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi.
Somalia's elections, which were slated to begin last weekend, have been postponed again. The government now says the polls won't start until late October. Jason Patinkin has more from Mogadishu.
Somalia's parliamentary elections have been pushed to October 23rd. The presidential vote has been rescheduled for November 30th. The internationally backed process has been beset by problems. There is political wrangling over voter delegates. National and state authorities complain the international community hasn't given pledged funding. Meanwhile, crucial institutions such as a dispute resolution commission remain unformed. Adam Ibrahim Al-Hirsi, the justice minister of Jubaland State, said the delays are no surprise.
The capacity of the people that promised that they will get things done should have been doubted from day one. Everybody knew this wasn't happening on time because the push from the international community, especially to those who deal with Somalia from diplomatic offices, wanted something great to report to their respective countries that wasn't in sync with the reality on the ground.
But the elections will still represent a major gain for Somalia when they do happen, says presidential spokesperson Dawood Awais.
Although this is not going to be a direct election, but it's a first step. This is a country which has not held elections for 47 years. Many people in this country, if you talk about them about the elections, they even don't know how to cast their votes.
Technically, Somalia held a presidential poll in 2012 when parliament elected President Hassan Mohamud. But it's true there hasn't been a poll of the people since the 1960s. This year's polls won't be a one-person, one-vote process. Due to security concerns, 14,000 delegates will vote for parliament. The new parliament will then choose the president. Joe Contreras, spokesperson for the United Nations Assistance Mission in Somalia, says this model isn't ideal. But he says it is better than the 2012 poll when only 135 clan elders voted.
I don't think that anyone is calling this a democratic election in the sense that most of us think of a democratic election.
Yet already this small electoral process has been hampered by accusations of misconduct. Opposition candidate Abdurrahman Abdishakur Warsame says the government is undermining other candidates, including tearing down his campaign posters.
Government is still trying to use the state resources and state security apparatus and state money and state institutions for advancing one particular candidate, which is the incumbent president.
The government denies that accusation. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Mogadishu.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, a conversation with Arthur Opio Oloya about his book, Black Hawks Rising, the story of AMISOM's successful war against Somali insurgency. That's next, right here on Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
Democracy in action. That's what the U.S. presidential election is all about. Who's going to be the new president of the United States come November 8th? Tune in to VOA's coverage of the 2016 presidential election. Reports, expert analysis, and more. Professional, up-to-the-minute coverage that can't be found anywhere else. Right here on VOA.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.